Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Adam Meyerson. I'm president of the Philanthropy Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us at our 20th annual meeting. This year, over 430 philanthropists are attending. This is one of our two largest annual meetings ever. The ancient Phoenicians were great voyagers, traders, and entrepreneurs. They were a creative people who invented the alphabet. So here at the Modern Phoenician, we hope that the next 48 hours will be a voyage of discovery for you, that as you trade ideas with other philanthropists, you will be stimulated in your own creativity in solving our country's greatest challenges. I want to thank every single person in this room individually. If I don't come up to you to say thank you, please come over and say hello to me. It's also traditional for us to give a special welcome to our newcomers. So would all of you who are here for the first time at a roundtable annual meeting, please stand. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd like each of our long-term friends to get to know some of the newcomers and make them feel at home. As for our long-term friends, how many here are at a roundtable annual meeting for at least the third time? Please rise. Thank you so much for coming again. Thank you so much to the sponsors of this conference, whose generosity has helped to make this annual meeting possible. And a special thanks to the William E. Simon Foundation for enabling us to administer the William E. Simon Prize for Philanthropic Leadership. Our ceremony honoring this year's winner, Charles Koch, will take place tomorrow at lunch. I'd also like to thank my staff colleagues at the roundtable, and especially our annual meeting director, Lindsay Miller. Roundtable staff have a blue ribbon on our name tags. If there's anything we can do to assist you at this conference or afterwards, please do not hesitate to ask us. Speaking of name tags, please wear yours. Hotel security has asked us to make sure that conference participants wear name badges at all events, including meals. Our theme this year is Can-Do Philanthropy, Solving America's Greatest Challenges. Charitable giving has been a distinctive feature of American life since the early days of our republic. It is central to the can-do spirit of our free society, where individuals and communities step up to solve problems without waiting for government to act. Here are just a few examples of breakthroughs that philanthropy has helped to achieve since the roundtable was founded 20 years ago. A one-third drop in the age-adjusted death rate for breast cancer. The creation of multiple networks of high-performing charter schools where low-income African American and Latino children excel academically. A two-thirds decline in teen crystal meth abuse in Montana, with similar results in Idaho and here in Arizona. The construction of the world's premier recovery centers for wounded servicemen suffering from traumatic brain injury and missing limbs. The creation of one of the world's greatest museums of American art, which will open in a few weeks in Bentonville, Arkansas. State-based think tanks of left, right, and center that have enriched public debate and discourse on the great policy issues of our times. The rapid growth of microcredit lending, which has enabled tens of millions of people worldwide to start businesses. The recovery of the Peregrine Falcon, a model for reviving populations of endangered species. and the slow and tortuous but incredibly significant building of civil society and independent nonprofits in China. I could go on all day about the amazing achievements of philanthropy, but let me point to two serious dangers facing charitable giving in the years ahead. The first is economic stagnation. The recession and economic slowdown have confirmed the wisdom of one of our core principles at the Roundtable, which is that a vibrant private sector economy generates the wealth that makes philanthropy possible. Our nation is entering a period of great debates about the size of government, the nature of entitlement programs, the structure of taxation. Philanthropists and people in this room may take different sides in these great debates, but we can all agree that it is crucial for the future of charitable giving that we see public policies that will lead to a revival of vigorous private sector economic growth. A second threat comes from activist groups and political leaders of both parties who seek to overregulate charitable giving and to take control of philanthropic resources for their own purposes. The Philanthropy Roundtable and our legislative arm, the Alliance for Charitable Reform, will continue to protect the freedom of donors and foundations at both the state and federal level. More recently, there has been an assault on the charitable deduction itself. The president's proposal to cap the charitable deduction was beaten back by a broad coalition of United Ways, churches and synagogues, museums, universities, and other organizations, including ours. But in this age of massive government debt and an insatiable search for revenue, we can expect more such proposals. The Philanthropy Roundtable is committed to protecting and preserving the charitable deduction, which has made such a difference for our civil society for 100 years. Speaking of 100 years, this is the 100th anniversary of the Carnegie Corporation. Later this afternoon, we will hear from Vartan Gregorian, Carnegie's president. Carnegie famously said that the main consideration of the philanthropist should be to help those who cannot help themselves, to provide part of the means by which those who desire to improve may do so, to give those who desire to rise the aids by which they may rise, to assist, but rarely or never to do it all. This is the spirit of can-do philanthropy. It is the spirit of this conference. Thank you so much for joining us. I now have the privilege of calling our opening plenary speakers to the stage and of introducing the moderator. Please stand. For the last 12 years, as president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, Paul Brest has been one of the distinguished voices of principled liberalism within philanthropy. By principled liberalism, I am referring to his commitment to science, reason, internationalism, intellectual freedom, and opening opportunity to all. The Philanthropy Roundtable is honored to have worked closely with Paul in protecting the future of foundations as independent private decision makers. Paul has also left two important marks on the field of philanthropy itself. The first is his serious discussion of strategy, the guidance he has provided funders in how to determine goals, theories of change, desired outcomes, assessing progress, and evaluating impact. The second is his emphasis on creating a philanthropic marketplace and laying the groundwork for better functioning capital markets in the nonprofit sector. I also believe that 50 years from now, historians will look upon Hewlett's support of open courseware at MIT as one of the great philanthropic achievements of the past decade. This advance in the diffusion of knowledge is an outstanding example of the creativity and innovation that philanthropy makes possible. There are now 2,000 courses at MIT that are available free on the internet to anyone in the world. The roundtable is honored that Paul is speaking at a roundtable annual meeting for the seventh time. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Paul Brest.
Well, thank you very much, Adam. Am I mic'd? Thank you, Adam. It sounded a bit like an obituary, which actually I am retiring from the foundation, but I'm at least so far as I know alive and well. So our panel is going to introduce the theme of the roundtable meeting, which is challenges facing our society and the world. And the challenges are many and easy to define. Solving them is much harder. And solving them through philanthropy, I think, through the lens of philanthropy, has its own particular challenges. We have two distinguished panelists to discuss this matter, and I'm not going to give them as long introductions or as glorious introductions as Adam gave me, but they deserve them. Both are relatively new to their organizations. Both had extremely distinguished academic careers before that, and Bob, before his academic career, was in public service before that. We worked to identify some clusters of issues, and I'll just tell you how we came to discuss the issues we're going to discuss today. I asked both of the panelists, Arthur and Bob, to identify what they thought were among the most important issues that they thought philanthropy in the nonprofit sector could address. And then I somewhat arbitrarily, but with a little bit of structure, broke them into 3.5 clusters. The first one is the looming fiscal crisis and issues of fairness, which I think relate to ways in which society might address that. The second is sort of a composite of issues that both of them were concerned with: education, entrepreneurship, and immigration. The third, which I think, to my mind, is the most pressing long-term issue that this society faces, and I'm going to leave it for last, is sort of a mixture of the issues of polarization and of evidence-based policymaking. And then a fourth, if we have chance, but we'll work it in if we can, is something that the MacArthur Foundation has been particularly concerned with, which is issues of nuclear security. So we'll see how it goes. The way I'd like to structure this is for each of these issues, either Arthur or Bob will go first. Arthur, I think, will start with the first one, the looming fiscal crisis. Each one will take not more than 5 minutes. Then what I'd like to do, rather than leaving all the Q&A for the end, after each of these clusters of issues, let's take 5 minutes for comments and questions from you all, because I expect that this will energize you. So thank you again both, and why don't we begin with Arthur?
Thank you, Paul, and thank you to all of you. I think this is my fifth philanthropy roundtable. And it's an honor to be here every year. It's a delight to see so many of AEI's friends and so many of my personal friends here. And I'm especially honored to be part of a panel kicking off this question of what are the big challenges that we face. Now, in contemplating the big challenges that we face, it's most straightforward, sort of conventional, to think of the material challenges that we face and the material challenges that we've actually conquered in the past and what we can learn from those things. But I actually think that the big challenges that we face today that philanthropy can and should be addressing are moral as opposed to material. And I want to give you an example. Something that everybody who's paying attention in America knows is that we have a deep and dangerous, very looming fiscal crisis. Today, the United States owes in public debt 100% of our GDP. We're running a $1.3 trillion deficit this year. Our public debt will be 187% of GDP by 2035, which by historic standards is simply not sustainable. We're paying $200 billion a year as a country in debt service and at historically low rates of interest. If the interest rate that we faced on U.S. Treasuries were to increase by 1%, that would increase our debt service cost by $100 billion a year. Right there. The reason for this, of course, is because we have a society chosen to have a very, very expensive level of public sector. We have seen the government grow massively over the past decades. In 1940, government at state, local, and federal levels came to 15% of GDP. Today, it's 36% of GDP. According to the Congressional Budget Office, it will be 50% of GDP by the year 2038. These are societal decisions that we are taking that are creating the fiscal trouble that we're talking about that we simply need to fix. We can't grow our way out because we've been finding that the American economy has been slowing down. The average GDP growth rate in the 50s and 60s was over 4%. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was a little over 3%. In the first 10 years of this decade, actually the first 8 years of this decade, before we were firmly in the crisis, it was 1.5%. Of course, lately it's been a lot lower than that, but we hope that's an outlier. What a lot of economists tell us is that we are on track for something like permanent malaise. None of us wants to accept that. And before we talk about those material issues, because those are the material facts, I want to talk about what we can do about that and then get to the moral crux of the problem. The United States has to face something that economists call fiscal consolidation. Either we're going to have to cut spending or we're going to have to raise revenues. Looking at countries around the world, 21 countries over the past 35 years, we know that the countries that are most likely to succeed in their fiscal consolidations are the ones that cut government spending. The ones that are most likely to fail are the ones that try to depend on enhanced revenue. We find that those that are average successful fiscal consolidations only rely on 15% new revenues. They rely 80%, 85% on cutting spending, and the most successful ones are more than 100% cutting spending by actually allowing the entrepreneurial sectors in their countries to flourish by cutting taxes. Now, why do I say that that's an issue? And here's really my point before I stop, which is when we ask why we don't pursue policies that many economists believe are most likely to solve our fiscal problems, our politicians turn to a very moral issue, which is fairness. Why don't we depend largely on spending cuts or entirely on spending cuts when we are in a crisis of spending? Because we need more fairness and balance in our tax code, we hear from politicians, including from the President of the United States. We're proposing and pursuing policies that we believe probably won't work because of a claim that's profoundly moral as opposed to practical. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but we need to examine exactly what we're saying and what we want to do. And so the question is this: what's fairness? Do we agree with the administration's definition of redistributional fairness, or do we not? What do Americans think fairness really means? We are in a position in the world of philanthropy to address this topic, to have something like a soul searching. This is not just for theologians. These are policy questions in the age of fiscal consolidation for economists and philanthropists, and only then can, by addressing the moral topic, can we get to what most economists see is the biggest threat facing our country today?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before I turn to Bob, let me just say that after Bob talks, I'd like to ask a question of both panelists before we turn to you, which is, this is the issue that Arthur has raised are clearly a pressing set of issues. I'd like to come back to the question of how philanthropy can help address those.
Paul, I'm as usual, I'm starting confused. Should I be commenting on what Arthur said, or would you like me to go to the second issue?
No, let's say with the first issue, fine. Comments or your own views. No, we'll do one issue at a time.
Perfect. I also want to thank you all for coming. I'm very grateful to be with you. And I'm noting this is the second time in a week I've I've been in front of an audience and the decision was made that we would sit in overstuffed chairs, which has me starting off feeling like Lily Tomlin, which is not the very best body posture for me. So, I am very pleased with the first topic, the topic of our fiscal future, because before I came to the MacArthur Foundation a couple of years ago, the decision was made to fund a study by the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Administration on our fiscal future. And they produced a report which subsequently the two commissions which met in parallel to address the President's Commission and the Bipartisan Senators Commission both used that study and its calculations as a guideline to figure out what kind of mix of policies might best address our fiscal future. And while this is all very complicated stuff and is not something that I was particularly involved in before I came to the Foundation, I was also struck by its simplicity as well as its complexity, which is to say there fundamentally are only two variables, you know, how much money we take in and how much money we spend. And if you find it's not working out now and you want to fix it so that instead of talking about the debt as a percentage of GDP, we don't end up talking about GDP as a percentage of debt, then you have to have some mix or go entirely one way or the other way with respect to increased revenue and decreased spending. And in fact, in this National Academy study, they came up, I think, with seven of these mixes. And it seems to me that, or it seemed, I should say in past tense, that it should not be beyond the mind of man to figure out a mix of increased revenue and decreased spending, which would address the problem. And, you know, without wanting to sound too much like a lawyer, I would stipulate to something Arthur said, which is the bulk of this should probably come from reduced spending as opposed from increased revenue. And the people whom I would regard as rational say that, and that seems okay with me. I think the real issue, and I don't take issue with the framing of this question, is the question of fairness. What is it that we want to do? Do we really want to say that we want to address this problem entirely by cutting spending and without increasing revenue? There are a number of ways of increasing revenue, but the most direct way is clearly by increasing taxes. And for me, that seems draconian, given my concept of fairness and values. So I would have the bulk of it be in the reducing expenditures. When one looks at reducing expenditures, though, there are only a few places to go to get the kinds of dollars that are needed. There are not a lot of places to go. Defense is one, but we're quite concerned about not going too far in that direction, lest we hurt the national security of the United States. And then we're rapidly into what some people like calling the entitlement programs. And I think most people who follow this would believe that there's something needs to be done about Social Security. It has a lot to do, independent of the fiscal crisis, it has a lot to do with the fact that people live longer and are healthier, which is a good thing. Actuarially, it's not such a good thing in terms of the Social Security. So I would regard the Social Security problem as fundamentally first a problem in arithmetic, and secondarily a question about exactly how one does that, but again, not a particularly extraordinarily difficult social problem. The key issue here for me is healthcare, and that's where the dollars are. That accounts for an awful lot of the growth, I think, that Arthur referred to earlier. It is growth in government programs, but not necessarily forced upon us by government. There's a system that needs to be addressed. I think as soon as one says that, one is into the question of what is fairness in this. And I think a question that's related to that, and that is what is the proper role of government overall in our society? What do we expect from it? How much are we willing to pay for it? How much is too much government? When does it get in the way of private enterprise? I've got those as all legitimate questions. I do not start off with the proposition that no government is best. I know I believe there are things in a fair and just society that are only going to be accomplished if there's government intervention and a role for government. I do not believe that the market is the solution to every single problem. I don't believe you can overcome the market in many problems. So it's for me, this is all a matter of finding out what the balance is, looking at the implications, and then asking, as Arthur said, what is a fair society? What are we aiming for? One other thing before I close, and that is on the question of fairness, there was a CBO report, Congressional Budget Office report, just a couple of days ago, on the concentration of wealth and income in America today. And that concentration has been observed by any number of people, academics and otherwise, as being relatively unique, not having seen these percentages, in other words, a very small percentage of the people having such a large percentage of the wealth and income in the United States since the 1920s. That does not immediately scream to me, we have to redistribute wealth in America. I don't move from the first to the second. I do want to know why it happened. I do want to know what the implications of this, and I recognize it is a tad pejorative, but I want to know what the implications of a, quote, hyper concentration of wealth are for American democracy. I want to know whether what some economists have said, namely that this is a natural outgrowth of globalization, of a middle class that has not been competitive and has consequently been hollowed out. We are currently confronting a non-recovery recovery, which has a little bit to do with the lack of expenditure by a middle class that is not expending what one would have hoped to have it expend to achieve this recovery. These things may be related. There's also a question of whether and if there is anything to be done about it. We are going to talk about education soon, and for me, that's the next place I would go. I wouldn't go for government intervention initially. I would go to education and see whether we can produce a more competitive middle class. But I'd also want to know whether it has been government policy that has contributed in substantial ways to this concentration of wealth. And if it has, we ought to look at that and we ought to ask ourselves, is it fair? Is it just? Is it producing the kind of society we want? And if it isn't, we should do something about it.
Thank you. So before turning it over to you, I want to come back to my promised or threatened question to both Arthur and Bob, which is everybody in this room is connected with philanthropy in some form. Some of you are the donors themselves. Some of you are members of families. Some of you are staffs or foundations. And the one thing that we all have in common is we want our philanthropic dollars to make a difference. So let's think about some of the different ways that we and the nonprofit organizations we support can make a difference, kind of structurally. We can do research and disseminate knowledge. We can do sort of R&D work, kind of pilot programs coupled with evaluation to see what works and what doesn't. A lot of that's being done in education, for example. We can provide services. That is, once we know that something works, we can provide educational service, or we can provide services in the form of museums and arts. We can advocate for policy change to policymakers, or we could also advocate to the population at large, taking one of Arthur's last points, soul-searching. We can support public soul-searching in the idea of getting citizens to think. Maybe some other strategies, but that seems to me kind of basically the kinds of things that nonprofits do and foundations fund. I'll give you an anecdote about our work in the same area involving the fiscal crisis, and then ask Arthur and Bob to talk about the role of the nonprofit sector, what's needed at this point on the issues we've just discussed. We also, around the same time probably that the MacArthur Foundation was involved, we did a set of grants. We made a joint grant to Brookings and the Heritage Foundation, and then I can't remember the name of the organization that Maya McGinnis runs, but a bipartisan organization concerned with fiscal issues. And we also supported David Walker, who is now running the Peterson Foundation, to go on what we called a fiscal wake-up tour. At that time, which was maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago, the assumption was there's still more research needed to understand how one could deal with the fiscal crisis, but also a sense from the word wake-up that it was really an important time to get the population and policymakers involved. Like so much advocacy, it's interesting. You can go along for a long time and nothing happens. And then, of course, this society has woken up very quickly, whether or not the politicians deal with the issue responsibly. There was a very sudden wake-up call. No doubt the Tea Party played a role beyond anything that could have been expected 5 years ago. But we're woken up to that. So the question, I guess, for Arthur and then for Bob is, what is the ongoing role for the nonprofit sector, think tanks and others, and for philanthropy, now that we've woken up to the issue in trying to help the U.S., let's just stick with the U.S., which is a big enough problem, solve it?
Thanks, Paul. You can come at the answer to this from a lot of different ways. What are the ways that we can do good? So on the issue at hand, we're talking about fiscal problems that we have at hand. 10 years, I'm an economist, which tells you I study the answers to questions that people have never asked, basically. And 10 years ago, I would have said that the solutions to this problem that can come from philanthropy are largely mechanical. What are the options at hand? What I'm saying here today is I think I repudiate that. And the reason I repudiate that is because it doesn't get to the core, the root causes of what we're talking about. I mean, here's the interesting thing about a lot of the mechanical problems that we have in public policy and in our society. They come down to values debates. Philanthropy is uniquely situated to go deeply into values debates with respect to advocacy, to education and exposure of what values debates really are about, as well as research on fundamental values in our society. If you look at most of the Simon Award winners, these are people who focus in their philanthropy on deep values issues. Roger Hertog, Phil Anschutz, Frank Hanna, Charles Koch, these people who do what they do, not to get at the mechanics of society, but to get at the values that undergird the problems that have mechanical manifestations. So what I'm saying is that it's important to think bigger in advocacy, education, and research on something like, indeed, fundamental fairness. What is it, and how can we get more of it?
Thank you. Bob.
I'm tempted to say, Paul, that you gave the best answer to your own question by analytically laying out the continuum that we in foundations tend to think about, which is to say we think, sometimes we call it upstream, and that's basic research where we think we don't know enough to really get into a policy issue. Then you move further along and you start saying, okay, there are different ways. We think we understand the dynamics a little better. And then it's kind of the middle level and we're trying to develop options and think about different ways of accomplishing something. And then we end up downstream. I mean, never ever, of course, acting inconsistent with what the tax law says we're allowed to do, but up to the water's edge, which is to say that if we figure out that there is a course that we can advocate, and it is not the kind of advocacy that's prohibited to us. For example, if we are in a field, as we are, of juvenile justice reform, we don't run into any trouble by saying we've figured out, with the research we've done before, we've figured out that there are mechanisms by which we can reduce the number of kids who end up in the juvenile justice system and thereby reduce the number of kids who are recidivists. We can increase the safety to the community, we can reduce the cost to the community, and we can improve the condition of these kids. So we can be advocates there. I'm not saying this is value-free, but it's not controversial values. And so we end up pushing something, and with no apologies here, about how to approach juvenile justice reform. But a lot of our stuff also is quite upstream. The stuff we have done on an aging network. Aging network has told us a lot about what it is like now and what it's going to be like as we look into the future, in that catchy phrase, where there are more walkers than strollers in America, what is that going to be like? And what are the implications of that all as they ripple through the whole of society? So I think I don't want to disagree with Arthur's proposition that there are times when the philanthropist ought to recognize the value and seize on it. I think for us, the correct role very often, the core of what we do is around the idea of raising the quality of the debate, teasing issues out, making sure we understand what the implications are of choosing one course as opposed to another course. And then when we find something unambiguously beneficial, we will go in that direction. We make bets in philanthropy, as somebody said. We're sort of venture capitalists, although that gives us a little too much credit, I think. But we take risks. We invest in some areas. We don't know whether it's going to be successful. It's one of the great things that the private philanthropists can do. And that's our obligation, is to do that responsibly. In this particular area, I think what we have done so far is done a lot to make clear what implications are. We are now moving, having done the national thing, Paul, we are now looking at the state and local level to ask what the implications are there of the crunch that many states are feeling, where they're trying to figure out how they can be true to the commitments they have made to various public workers for their future, while at the same time providing for public safety, providing for education, fulfilling the other functions. The crunch is going to come in America much more directly and quickly at this level, at the local and state level. So what we're busy doing now is not so much solving this problem per se, but trying to make clear what the issues are, where the tensions are, and what the implications of various choices might be, and perhaps even being creative about developing choices, all in the interest of outcomes which meet the test of fairness. It's a very tough test. I want to close on one point, and it is the moral part that goes sometimes with the fairness part. And I am troubled by that. And I will let me be clear why, or try to be clear why. As soon as a public policy issue becomes moral, a moral issue, those who take a position on it undoubtedly believe they are taking the moral position. Not so bad. But when someone takes a different position, they are almost perforce taking the immoral position. That does not create a lot of legitimate ground for compromise. Now, some of you who are unkind in this audience may have noted that what Paul called government service was service with the Department of State, and I have a long, over 20-year history of negotiating, and you're thinking dark thoughts about my enthusiasm for compromise. Okay, fair enough. We can go there if you wish. But what I'm saying right now is to take issues and make them moral issues can, if you're not careful, destroy the legitimate ground for compromise. And if I were going to anticipate discussion part three, that's where it goes for me.
Thank you. And now for some of you, probably not the issue of, you know, where you come out on spending cuts versus revenue, but how you think philanthropy, your foundations or others, can help address what I think both Arthur and Bob and probably everybody in this room regards as pressing issues. Yes, ma'am. Are there microphones that we can?
Giselle Huff with the Jacqueline Newman Foundation. In my definition of fairness, there's an underlying concept of efficacy. And you can't be fair if whatever you do doesn't work. And I'm wondering whether you think that there is a role for foundations to act as watchdogs so that when policies are put in place, there is a follow-through to see whether or not they actually accomplish what they were supposed to do.
Great. And I think what we'll do is we'll take a few questions and comments and then ask Bob and Arthur to comment on all of them. Yes.
Doesn't the concept of fairness also get us into the issue of egalitarianism? And shouldn't we, to some extent, address that? I mean, this goes back to Rousseau. Fairness definitely implies distribution and the validity of private property. I think we need to touch on that, don't we?
A few other questions or comments. Surely they must have provoked you more than this. Yes.
Hi, Mike Lynn Wright with the Wheeler Family Foundation. When you talk about fairness and you talk about reducing spending, I've always looked at philanthropy as a way, and philanthropists as individuals that are willing to step up to the plate and help their fellow man achieve a better lifestyle. And I sort of look at, you know, if the government did reduce taxes and if philanthropy were to step up to the plate. And, you know, with all of the experimenting people have done in this room and across the nation, I think we would come up with a lot better solutions to social problems than the welfare system, than government-run schools. And I could go on and on about just about every aspect that government does. I think philanthropists would do a better job.
Thank you. One more comment, and then yes, in back.
Thank you. Is this on? Paul Merrill with GFC Foundation. I wonder if Mr. Brooks might address the implication that values, speaking of values and morality, is somehow divisive.
Okay, so why doesn't Bob take a moment and answer, respond to this cluster of issues, and then Arthur, and then we'll move on to the next set.
Lest I be misunderstood as opposed to mischaracterized, I don't shy away from values or morality. There was a caution here about how one frames a position of advocacy on some social issues. And if the claim is that my position is the moral position, yours is the immoral position, I'm simply saying it does not, as a prima facie case, leave a legitimate ground for many people over which to compromise. And when I look at what I see in the House of Representatives on several issues, I see very heavy doses of ideology, values, morals, however one wants to characterize this. And I see, in other words, less middle in the House of Representatives than I see in America. Now, that's a proposition, may or may not be true. It would take a while to prove it, but it's instinct. And it's just a caution. I believe that we at the MacArthur Foundation have very important values. We pursue them. I believe there's another place where I would put for morality, but that's there too. But it's caution. With respect to the role of government, I may have a different view about the role of government than some in the audience do. I don't think it is the issue confronting the United States of America today. I don't think that the issue is if we could get government out of the way, then everything would be fine with the economy. And the problem up to now is there's been too much government. Those are propositions I would not sign on to. I do believe that there's got to be less expenditure. And I said before that I'd go after one area with this, which I believe one has to if one just looks at the pie, about where the dollars are, when it would have to go to healthcare. And try to do that, impact healthcare, to reduce expenditures in a way that is fair and sensitive to human beings. But I would argue to you it has to be done. So I don't protect all government spending, but I do believe there is a legitimate role for government in our society. With respect to the first observation, that doesn't efficacy matter, I'd say it matters a whole lot. I mean, we have watchwords at our foundation which are common to other foundations, and, you know, one word is impact of our grant making, that we're getting something like the outcomes that we're looking for. Another word is leverage or leverage, which is to say that we're looking to bring about through our grant making a larger outcomes, systemic outcomes, structural outcomes. That's what we, I think, generally call strategic grant making. And third, we want to be as rigorous as we can in assessing and evaluating our work to see whether it's effective or not. And if you have a well-meaning foundation and completely ineffective in what you're trying to accomplish, that's a pretty big hit, I think. It is also fair to say, though, and I will close on this point, that as soon as you say you want to be a risk-taking foundation, and I want us to be a risk-taking foundation, that, I say again, is something that private philanthropy can be and ought to be. Something, and some things are just not going to work. And, you know, if we talk about education in a few minutes, I will tell you this is an area in which I'm very excited about what we're doing, but it's a high-risk enterprise. What I would promise here is that we will do everything we can to make it work, and if it doesn't work, two things will be true. We will have found out it doesn't work by assessing the work, and then we'll be transparent about it and tell everybody it didn't work. That's all we can do.
Thank you. Arthur.
I want to emphasize something that Bob said that I think is important, that I agree with a lot. We can have a conversation about differences in morality, differences in what we think are moral policies. The danger is letting that skate into an argument that somebody who disagrees with you is an immoral person. That's when things get so divisive that they get a little bit dangerous. And let me give you an example of that. In the debates over what was arguably the most important political movement, certainly of my adult lifetime, which is the Tea Party movement that led to the wave election of 2010, it was entirely legitimate for people who disagreed with that movement to say that the policies that they were promoting of cutting back government in some cases across the board, it was entirely legitimate, whether or not I agree or disagree, to say that those were not moral policies. It was not legitimate what many in the White House and in the Congress did to say that, therefore, the Tea Party protesters were immoral people. That was not a legitimate thing to do, and that's the danger, I think, that Bob is talking about, that we have to be ever vigilant against when we talk, when we go into the realm of moral politics and moral policies. That said, we can't shy away from these things. It's important that we talk about divisive things. The probably the most dangerous thing that we could do is to let moral arguments go unstated such that they can become caricatures of themselves. One of the great things about a free society is it's characterized by the competition of ideas, the competition even of moral ideas. One of the things that there are many things that I love about America, and I know you do too, but, you know, I wasn't especially supportive of the Obama campaign in the year 2008. And that notwithstanding, I'm the president of a major think tank in the United States, and it was pretty clear where I stood on a lot of issues. The day after Barack Obama won election, my kids still got to go to school. There was no knock in the night. If I called the police, they would still come to my house. That's a wonderful thing that we can have moral debates about deep values-based issues, and at the same time, we can refrain from vilifying each other. So in answer to your question, are moral debates divisive? Yes. Is that okay? Yes. Do we actually have to have restraint when we talk about the character of others? Yes, I think so. In answer to a couple other questions, foundations as watchdogs for government? That's great. Absolutely. That's a great role for foundations. Can foundation support substitute for government spending? Yes, it should. Absolutely. The whole idea of private individuals providing public goods, it's a fantastic thing. And furthermore, it can do so in a way that's more innovative, that's more facile, and furthermore, they can teach governments how to do things better if and when they take over functions in the future. We do have a public good role. We shouldn't be crowded out. We must insist on paying for public goods. That is our, in my view, moral right.
So I'm not a panelist, but I'll make a final comment, half agreeing and half disagreeing with Arthur's point. Absolutely, I agree we should not demonize the person who makes an argument. But I also think that we are much too quick to take arguments that are really complex and pragmatic and make the arguments themselves moral sides. When usually there is so much complexity. You know, there's some arguments. arguments, for example, over abortion, which come down to moral issues, the fiscal and fairness issues we're talking about, we have so much hard work to do before there are deep moral positions, I think, that I wouldn't get there too quickly. Okay. The second is a grab bag, which I put together, of issues that Bob and Arthur thought were both important. Education, and we'll begin with Bob, but I hope we'll talk about the other two, and then Arthur, immigration and entrepreneurship.
So, education. Before coming to MacArthur, I spent 13 years as a dean at Georgetown. And not every week, but certainly at least once a month or twice a month, somebody would come to me from Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and say, our school wants to partner with your school. And I checked with my colleague deans of schools of international affairs at Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, SAIS at Johns Hopkins, Kennedy School, etc. They all had similar experience. The world has generally concluded that the United States of America has broken the code. We know how to do higher education. And that may or may not be true, but that is the perception. I can tell you that it doesn't happen every day or every week or probably even once a year that people from other countries come to the United States, go to the Chicago public school system and say, can you tell us how you do what you do? Because we want to have a system just like yours. And that would be true of any number of other public school systems. So my first point is, I think it is arguable, I would argue it, that our K through 12 system in the United States of America is broken, largely broken. And coming to MacArthur as I did and finding that there wasn't a traditional, what I would call traditional K through 12 program at MacArthur distressed me. And I discovered that there had been, and it was given up some years before I got there, because it wasn't in the assessment, it wasn't showing up to have had much impact on the public school system where the money was being spent. We had broken the code, if I can use that phrase again, with some charter schools in some places where a lot of resources were put on a small number of students, and we got good outcomes. But we hadn't broken the code on how to scale this up and improve a public school system. The propositions that were around are consistent with a wonderful little documentary many of you may have seen, Waiting for Superman. Okay, a sweet documentary, but for us, and I think for America, we can't wait for Superman. And the blinding insight that good teachers are better than bad teachers and students and parents would prefer good teachers, we got that. That good principals are better than bad principals and we ought to have more of them, we got that too. But we don't have those people to spread all around in our K through 12 system. So there's a frustration out there. I'm not saying there are no traditional reforms that work, I'm just saying that I don't think we have yet in our hand intellectually what we want. So remember my prior response to Paul's comment about how do foundations work, and I said sometimes we work way upstream. Well, right now we are upstream on this one. And on it, and I can tell you I think it's extraordinarily important. It's important in the terms we were just talking about in terms of the preparation of our young people for this global economy and for the types of jobs that are there as opposed for preparation for jobs that aren't there. It's important if we're going to be competitive in basic abilities to read, write, numeracy. It's going to be important if we're ready for this 21st century economy, which is different than a 20th century economy. So what are we doing? We have invested in, first, the upstream stuff of trying to figure out how kids learn these days. And the judgment was, again, before I got to the foundation, they learn differently than the way I learned, and looking out at this audience, I'd say, the way most of you learned. They are learning largely through various types of digital media. And I mean in the lowest economic areas, in the most troubled neighborhoods. They have access to this kind of media. And that's what they're doing. And the follow-on insight from that was that there should be a way, and there may be a way, to take advantage of digital media in learning. And so thus was born this area of work that the foundation is investing in. We are doing this on a small scale because it could fail, and it's much better to fail on a small scale than a big scale. So we invested in a Quest to Learn school in New York City. It was a regular public school, a couple of grades, integrated a lot of digital media in that, trying that out. We have done some networking of this kind of enterprise in libraries, principally at the large public library in Chicago called U-Media, which public school kids from all over Chicago come and work with various kinds of mentors in various segments of digital media, looking for, as we are, the impact on reading and writing as well as on the media work itself. And we have just opened the charter school last month in Chicago and plan on opening two more in which we'll be further using these as platforms to test digital media and learning to see whether through, and this may trouble some of you, a process largely that's based on what is commonly thought of as games or gaming, we can produce a conceptualization and a systematization of learning in the students' minds and make certain kinds of leaps that are not otherwise possible. This is not gripping onto technology and saying, how can we use computers? This is a much more subtle and sophisticated way of taking advantage of what kids are doing all day, every day. And if any of you have kids or grandchildren, you know what I'm talking about. The question is, can we use this inclination to get the kids to learn? I will say finally here that if we talk about the last issue, which is our political system in this country, I don't believe there's a long-term solution to improving the way our democracy works that does not require an improvement of K-12 education. We need kids who can think critically, who can read critically, who can write well. And we need kids who have modern civics education. That's what we're aiming to do. We think it's in the long-term interest of this country, fundamentally, economically, and politically. And we are very enthusiastic about what we are doing, but it is, I say again, a bet we are making. And I'd be happy to tell everybody what the outcome is when we get to assess it.
Arthur, you're free to talk about education and to link or not link issues of entrepreneurship as you wish.
That's really interesting. I'd kind of like to hear five more minutes from Bob about what they're doing, because we have a major education program at AEI that some of you are familiar with. We also do work on entrepreneurship and on immigration. And so I want to touch on what is the leitmotif that runs across all three of those things that motivates our work a little bit. And the core theme that unites entrepreneurship, education, and immigration in almost a unique way is the theme of the Opportunity Society. The United States is a country that's built on immigration, that's improved by education, and is made prosperous by entrepreneurship. Most countries around the world can't say that. Those are the three magic ingredients toward the kind of prosperity and flourishing that we enjoy today. They are the difference between what my friend Joel Klein, who's the former chancellor of schools in New York City, calls the difference between an opportunity society and a claimant society. We want the opportunity society, I dare say. I don't think any of us really wants a claimant society. So the question is then, when we do work, when AEI or does work, or any of you are behind or engaged in active work, how can the ideal of the opportunity society motivate work in education, in immigration, and in entrepreneurship? Well, in entrepreneurship, we've thought about that an awful lot, and the key idea is how can we get out of the way of innovators? An opportunity society requires that we not put up barriers in front of entrepreneurs. What can we do in tax and regulation, in predictable government that gets out of the way of entrepreneurs? That's the key question to ask. Number two, what should we be doing to introduce more entrepreneurship to the poor and vulnerable in this country? The Opportunity Society requires that the next generation of people who are materially prosperous have among them people who are not materially prosperous right now. That's how opportunity actually works. It's not opportunity for rich people to stay rich. It's for people who are not to be able to get ahead, and that means they have to have access to entrepreneurship. What are we doing today? One of the questions we ask ourselves at AEI, how is our work making it possible for people who are poor and vulnerable to become entrepreneurs? And third, culturally, what are we doing to help the United States to continue to have a culture that celebrates opportunity creators in our society as real American heroes, as opposed to effectively vilifying them, particularly in a time of deep fiscal consolidation, when it's easy to do so because many of them have money. Although I will point out that the average entrepreneur in America makes less per year than the average civil servant. An interesting factoid. The second is about education. How do we work the notion of the Opportunity Society through our education program? Clearly, Bob is doing that. That's what motivates your work, if I dare say so. And the key thing is systems that are designed for kids, not adults. What are we doing such that schools are better for children as opposed to providing a means of employment primarily for adults? I mean, it sounds obvious, but I think we often forget. And second, what is the ethic of innovation and creativity in education design? That's a lot of what you were talking about. I mean, if we want the Opportunity Society, it really starts there at the level of design and innovation in educational systems. Finally, in immigration. You know, when you feel like you're on thin ice all the time when you're talking about immigration, but not when you talk about immigration from the vantage of the Opportunity Society. I mean, we're in Arizona, so it's really a hot topic here. As far as I'm concerned, the right thing to be talking about in immigration is focusing on how the United States can attract and keep the world's best minds. How we can take people who have innovation and creativity, who have real talent, and who don't have opportunity, and to bring them here such that they can have opportunity, and to lift all the rest of us up. What are the policies that we need? The policies that we talk about at AEI are stapling a green card to every diploma. The things that basically left and right politically can more or less agree on, those are the immigration policies that really matter for an opportunity society, and those are the things that I think that we need to be focusing on in very positive, very optimistic philanthropy.
Thank you. Bob, do you want to say a word before we throw it open?
No, throw it open.
Great. Yes, sir.
I've been involved in school reform for the last 25 years, first starting with the I Have a Dream and then getting into advocacy and realizing there's no chance of changing things from the top, then doing charter schools and then coming to the conclusion there's no possible way with broadly improving public schools without a lot of technology. I mean, we've had the Nation at Risk 28 years ago advocating very good things, improving standards, more professional development, more money, et cetera, et cetera, and we have a flat line. So I think it's just Einstein's theory that if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, that's insanity. Well, we, for the last couple of years, have done what you have done, where we have three schools where the kids are spending two-thirds of their time online. They are, in every class, they're divided into three different groups, and then they alternate every half hour, where one group has one-to-one computing, they're learning at their level and at their speed and with immediate reaction. Another group is doing collaborative learning, where they are doing a project together online, learning to collaborate, to think independently, to think critically. Then another group is with a teacher who has all the data from the two online programs, and there are 48 kids in a classroom, but the teacher only has 16 at a time. The results are literally phenomenal. It's early days, but they come into our inner city schools in Los Angeles and East LA, South LA, at about a fourth grade level in reading and math, and I dare say that's what you'll find in Chicago. And within 1 year, they advance four full grades in those areas. Very, very happily, as you say, it's a different animal. I mean, these are people that learn to react at the age of two or three rather than be having the sage at the stage talking to them. So I would say, that the other component to broad improvement is the grassroots. And that's another area where philanthropists can help. The top is too strong. Technology is inexorable, but it can be held up for a long, long time. And without getting parents, getting philanthropists to be involved in making that change, so I would say that in funding different educational activities, there are a lot of great one-offs, but if you really want to make a broad change, do something that involves the 21st century and integrating technology. Billions of dollars have been spent on technology to have the computer over in the corner or a computer lab, but it needs to be integrated into the learning process. And I think that really fits with entrepreneurialism too. What is the big change in our economy is not so much globalization, but it's atomization, that technology has reduced transaction costs so that individuals can do things that they couldn't do since the agricultural. But they aren't taught that. We're always talking about the 3 billion jobs, the million jobs that are open because people are not trained. And I think it also fits in integration. I like the idea of the leaf motif, that I think that the young immigrants are one of our greatest assets. I mean, China is reproducing itself, for every two people, just 1.5 people are doing. We're the only Western country that has a barely positive birth rate. But if we could train all these wonderful young immigrants, that we would take care of a lot of our entitlement problems and have a much better and freer nation. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, back there.
While I applaud all of the technology, and I must admit that I'm not up on all of it, but I'm not a total dinosaur, I must ask, Bob, I applaud what you're doing in that technology opportunity. I think it's about the content. You know, the way that kids are learning, and the methodologies and the technologies behind and the platforms for learning is great. As a grandparent and a matter of fact, a great-grandparent, I worry about what they're learning. So I would ask you, are you doing anything or do you have any involvement in your program as to the content in the learning experience?
And again, I'll let Bob and Arthur respond. There was a gentleman right back there.
Yes, thank you.
After you, it's the gentleman in the blue
Sorry.
Sweater who...
Thanks. Just two quick comments, perhaps relating to some of the helpful things Mr. Colucci said. You mentioned Waiting for Superman, and after you saw that movie, I assume you saw that movie, did you feel that that movie raised profound moral questions? Secondly, this summer, we all learned of hundreds of Atlanta public school teachers and principals who took student proficiency exams home together for the weekend to have erasure parties so that they could erase the bad answers and put down the correct answers in order to improve the proficiency scores. So just two quick questions. In the light of these two, how does society and particularly philanthropy address these two examples of moral collapse by those who are supposed to be the exemplars of uplifting our society, advancing freedom, and so on? And the second part is, why have I not or have I'm not aware of anybody else who's heard of any follow-up as a result of the movie or the Atlanta scandal, such as having every school board, just before the beginning of the school year, watch that movie and then with the public attendance, discuss for 2 hours the meaning and the messages within that movie, Superman.
Okay, we have two more comments, one the gentleman there and then in front, and then we'll let Bob and Arthur respond, and then we'll move on.
Thank you very much. Chuck Stetson, Main Street Foundation. Question on education is, as you were pointing out, Mr. Gallucci, we have the research that we know that with family breakup, we're headed towards social and economic collapse. We also have some interesting stuff. We have Brookings and Heritage holding an event last week on the second chances for marriage, and they both agree. We have Bill Galston from Brookings. We have Robert Rector from Heritage. I mean, but we can't seem to get the information out there. We can't even seem to get the philanthropic support. What's going on here? I don't get it.
And finally,
Robin Hayes, Cannon Foundation. The Philanthropy Roundtable has a nice book, Reviving Marriage in America. Talk about that and traditional families and how that will help education.
Okay, I'm going to leave it to, I'll let Bob go first because then Bob's going to introduce the last issue and then Arthur responding.
First on content. We look very carefully at the content of what we're doing in the program on digital media and learning, and it is possibly the most exciting thing about the program. It depends a little bit on the technology because we're networking in ways that are interesting. I've met with first the museums and zoos and people who had these institutions in Chicago, then the same thing in New York. because we network the kids in with these institutions, and they have gone to some length to get people who can work the media connection to the schools that we have in order that the kids get access online to things they wouldn't otherwise have access to in order to do the various projects they've got. The projects, your content, very often involves challenges to the students. Design something. Design a plan for your neighborhood. Design a technical or solve a technical problem with a certain kind of design. They are, when I say games, they're problem-oriented, requiring what in the educational lingo is systems thinking, and has the kid move and integrate various kinds of what we would call separate subject areas in order to reach the solution. So I'm very enthusiastic about the creativity that is required to succeed in this kind of environment. But please be careful here. I am enthusiastic about it. We are investing in it. It has the potential, it seems to me, to be scalable if it works. And we haven't done the evaluations yet. I know I'm not sure that it will work. I don't think we're doing any harm to anybody as we open these schools. It's a lot of focus on here. But I don't know at the end of the day whether we're going to get the overall impact we want, not only on 21st century learning, what we need in those skills, but also, as I would say, 18th century learning. They have to be able to read, write, and do arithmetic. So we'll see how this goes. Watch this space. And we will be committed to transparency, which is to say, to tell the truth about what we learn in our assessment. But I'm hopeful. On the question of waiting for Superman and moral questions, does it raise moral questions? Are moral questions raised by what happened in the scandal, I guess, in Atlanta? Yes, and yes. I mean, I think that's right. If Waiting for Superman is anybody's favorite movie, I'm not trying to make a cut at it, except to say it did not, for me, as someone who's responsible for grant making at a foundation, direct me someplace that I thought was useful. It was tragic to me that the types of lotteries that go on to get the good teacher in the good class have to go on. It's tragic to me that state teachers' colleges very often don't produce particularly terrific supermen or superwomen. That's all unfortunate. We've been aware of this for a long time. I don't know how one goes about, through traditional reform, getting the numbers of supermen and superwomen we want in the classroom. So I'm enthusiastic about the tack we're taking. I don't mean to undercut programs that others may be taking. As to scandals, they happen. People ought to be aware of them. They ought not happen. And I'm happy to condemn them along with everybody else.
Thank you. Let me actually turn to Arthur so we can then go on to the third issue.
Sure. I think we covered a lot of the main points here, but I want to follow on Jack Templeton's point. There are a lot of scandals, and some of them, of course, are more than just punctuations of the equilibrium. The Atlanta scandal was particularly egregious, and I think everybody read about it was totally outraged by it. And you want redress when something like that happens. But one of the biggest problems that we see in education is sort of the slow brewing under the radar scandals. You know, I was a product of the Seattle public schools in the 1970s and 80s. I was a product of forced busing. I mean, come on. That sort of social engineering that we know is a failure and it went on for year after year after year, that's a slow motion version of what you saw in the punctuation to the general equilibrium in the Atlanta case. And that's the sort of thing that philanthropy as a watchdog can really bring to light. What are we doing that's hurting people and making education worse? And so I think that, you know, I would urge you to pay attention to a lot of the stuff that's not making news but really ought to be making news as well. The other thing is, speaking to Robin and Chuck's point about, you know, family values and such, I mean, those are specific cases, but one of the nice things about private philanthropy as opposed to public funding mechanisms is that you don't have to shy away from cultural issues that you think are actually creating some of the biggest problems in our education system and the biggest problems in in underprivileged life or in economically vulnerable life. So I would simply advocate to all of you that you continue to ask the really hard questions that you can ask that the government can't.
So before we turn to the third issue, I'm just going to, since we're not going to reach nuclear security, let me just say one word, which is, if there had been any sort of nuclear explosion of any sort in a U.S. city, that would be the only issue we'd be talking about. So enough said about the importance of that issue. So I want to set up the what I regard as the twin issues of polarization and evidence-based policymaking. And look, all policy involves facts and values. Let's come back to the first issue we were talking about. Underlying any fiscal policy are issues of fairness, autonomy, somebody's right to keep what he or she earns, claims of distribution. Those are the values. And then there are factual questions which may be uncertain, but they're nonetheless questions of fact, which is how a particular scheme is actually going to play out in the economy. I think that we are in a period, and I'm not suggesting this is the only time in our history, but certainly more than any other time in my adult life, when we are blurring the distinction, when people's belief about facts is based on ideology and values. You know, there's a word which I think a lot of us use in the nonprofit sector, evidence-based policymaking. What I think is going on among many policymakers is sort of policy or ideology-based evidence-making. And I think this affects our policymaking in the fiscal area, in issues of environment and climate and education, every place. And I think that the confusion of fact and values is part of what's polarizing us. Because when we can talk about facts, we can actually not just respect the other person, but actually dig in on what empiricism tells us. When it's only values, then we get down to you're immoral or I'm immoral very quickly. So with that set up, I'm going to ask Bob and then Arthur to have your own views on this.
So the proposition I'd put forth is that there are two troubling gaps in America today, that there appears to be some pathology affecting the federal government, at least, and maybe other levels of government. And I believe that that's one of the pathologies, and Paul is getting to it, is that there's a gap between the way our political institutions are supposed to function and our political culture not supporting that way of functioning. We have vision of power, separation of power. We have a political system which historically and intendedly works on compromise, right? Between branches of government, within government. That's the way it's supposed to work. There was, if you read The Federalist, and I know many of you, if not all of you, have, you know, there was great effort at coping with the factions and the problem of factions in the Federalist Papers. And our institutions were designed to deal with great diversity of opinion, strongly held opinion. And they're designed to function well when representative government in a republic reaches compromise. Right? That's the structural way we're organized, I would argue. Second, I'd say that structure is no longer supported by American political culture. American political culture has come to demonize compromise, to shun compromise, to make it very often morally unacceptable. I felt this, I made a reference to being in government service and engaged in negotiations which some members of Congress, I recollect, thought was bizarre. You're negotiating with North Koreans. You're negotiating with Bosnians and Serbians. You're negotiating with Iraqis. What are you thinking? You can't trust these people. What is a negotiation? Have you compromised in these negotiations? No, I don't compromise. I negotiate and give up nothing. Of course I've compromised. Well, then you've compromised the national security. I've heard enough. I've been witnessing the hostility to compromise for a long time, but it's really come into American domestic politics in a way that I think makes it very hard for the system to function. I referred before to the absence of a middle in the House, which I think still exists in the American people. But it is not an ethic of our culture that is embraced in the media. The media drives and polarizes, not all of it all the time, but much of it. And I think this is destructive to dealing with the kinds of issues that we as a foundation want to deal with. It might be climate change. It might be for serious kinds of environmental issues. It might be education. It might be health. It might be the problem of aging. We have lots of issues. And when we get to policymaking, we find a political system that is not serving the best interests of this country. And that's the first proposition, the gap between political culture and political institutions. The culture not being consistent with the kind of embrace of compromise which the institutions demand. The second is a gap between the polity and the complexity of the social and political issues. I would submit to you that some of this stuff is not very hard, but most of those social issues and political issues we want to deal with, as Paul indicated, are really complex. And we talk about this, and we do use the phrase evidence-based policy, evidence-based grant-making. And we'd like sophisticated discourse. But when you turn on the television, do you hear sophisticated-based discourse? I don't. What is it that we get? We get something that very often is bumper stickered, that's short, that's catchy, that's made ideological, that's made sometimes a question of morality. It is not a matter of reason. It is not a matter of evidence. It's not the kind of discourse that the complexity of the problem and the importance of the problem and the values that are embedded in the problem deserve. We haven't produced that in the polity. We haven't produced a polity that demands that. That has driven us, and me particularly, back to education. I want an education system, a K through 12, a public education system that produces students, youth, who will insist on understanding an issue and insist on a more sophisticated way of engaging it. And if we have that, I think the press and indeed the political system will have to deliver a type of discourse which is more befitting the complexity and importance of the issues that we have to deal with.
And I turn to the head of an institution that is renowned for its commitment to evidence.
Indeed. Indeed, I'm the head of an institution that's rigorously and relentlessly and exhaustingly empirical. But I actually want to argue in favor of polarization, just for a second. Polarization never gets its due. I know it's really tough. I live in Washington, D.C. When I moved there 3 years ago, one of my colleagues said, you think you're ready for this? You're running an institution in Washington. I thought, I don't know. He said, give me some advice. He said, know who your friends are. And I said, how do I know who my friends are? And he thought about it and he said, they're the ones who stab you in the chest. but that said, I mean, there are two assertions, sort of two things that everybody knows. One is that our politics are hugely polarized right now. And number two, that's really bad. And I'm not ready to sign on to those two propositions yet. One is that if you look historically, our politics are not more polarized than they were in the past. The Civil War, I mean, so that's radical. And that's bad. Go forward. Go to the time of Woodrow Wilson. Go to the time of the New Deal. I mean, there were times that were arguably much more polarized in American politics that produced very important outcomes and that were the fork in the road in public policy and ideology. And were it not for a very vigorous debate on as a society, how we want to deal with particular issues, we wouldn't have gotten the facts out. I mean, most of you run institutions. When you don't know how you feel about a particular issue, you actually want vigorous debate that's highly polarized. Now, I know it can go to an extreme, but I simply want to make the point that I'm not ready to sign on to say that things are historically worse than they've been, and furthermore, that it's really a bad thing. Now, when it gets to philanthropy, how should we be thinking about that? I believe deeply in evidence-based policy analysis as opposed to one that's simply polarized and ideological. And that to that end, I think that we can be promoting three things that help get us toward that goal. The first is an insistence when we are working with institutions, with think tanks, with universities, doing our own research in philanthropy on facts and data and less faddish theoretical work that feeds ideology. And this is a big problem on both right and left that we have right now. There is indeed ideology that's trying to look for data. It's a really easy thing to do, but we have to root it out. And the way that that problem is going to get solved, of course, is that investors simply won't invest in those types of exercises. So that's number one. I doubt there's anybody who disagrees with me on that. The second is we need more real intellectual diversity in our idea institutions. You know, and it's not just because it's some sort of a scandal because college campuses ideologically are so monochromatic. It's just because they provide a lousy education. When people simply don't get different viewpoints, different worldviews, of course that are motivated by facts and data. But I think it's really critical, and it's getting to the point that it's become an embarrassment. I mean, we find that we're sitting on a bubble in higher education. It's largely because people are realizing education is not worth the money because people are not being educated properly. So should we make college cheaper? Should we forgive student loans? Maybe. But should we make education better so it's a better deal, so it's a better investment? For sure. And diversity in experience and diversity intellectually, I think it's going to go a long ways toward making that so. And finally, we need more real public debate. One of the things that we've done at AEI is less trying to bludgeon people with work that we're doing with our point of view and actually simply trying to set it up with people who disagree with our point of view. Right now, we're in the middle of a campus debate series on a lot of campuses, dozens of campuses that we're on nationwide in a program we're doing with the Kern Family Foundation. And we're not simply sending out AEI scholars to talk about the virtues of free enterprise. We're actually doing debates. I personally am debating somebody who disagrees with me on most issues, a guy named Jim Wallace, who wrote a book called God's Politics. Who disagrees with my views about the free enterprise system. He's a real advocate for things that I don't advocate. And we stand up, we get equal time, and we talk about it in a civilized way. We both really care about human flourishing and making people better off. You know, that's what's going to enrich the debate more, ultimately. That's what's going to make people better educated, and that's actually going to use what some could call a highly polarized environment, because let me tell you, when I'm on the stage with Jim Wallace, it's highly polarized. But it's also really constructive.
Well, I hope that we have given you something to talk about among yourselves during the break. Let me thank both Arthur and Bob for what I hope has been a good beginning to a wonderful set of meetings around challenges. And thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks.
Thank you.
Nice.
Thank you.